Colleagues, welcome back to The Office. Welcome to our podcast for today. This is Are You Really Ready? Effective Disaster Recovery, Business Continuity Planning, Part 2. This is our 19th episode. Thank you so much for coming and thank you so much for being here. In today's podcast, we are going to be looking at various things that could be very useful for helping reduce your risk and exposure as it relates to disasters. You know, disasters of all types and sizes can occur, from hurricanes and tornadoes and earthquakes to data breaches, privilege misuse, and much more. In this series, we're looking at all the horrible things that could potentially happen to your organization and some things that you can do to help mitigate and reduce your risk and exposure to these items. You know, the best possible thing is to have a plan in place and never actually have to use it. But not having a plan in place can be absolutely detrimental to your organization because in the event that you need it, you're not going to have something that you can fall back to that's going to give you the guidance and direction to help reduce your risk and help bring back and come back online. So in our first section, and we'll do a quick recap here just in a little minute, talking about what we talked about in our first episode here. But in today's episode, what we're going to talk about today is primarily data breaches. And that is a phrase that hopefully strikes fear into everybody's heart, because it is something, in my opinion, that every organization is subject to and every organization could fall victim to at some point. And the risks and damages that can come from a data breach are truly outstanding and truly detrimental to your organization. And it doesn't matter if you're a dentist shop working on Main Street or you're a Fortune 500 company, having your data stolen and having it being used against you or made public for your customers can put you out of business or at the very minimum, absolutely tarnish your reputation in the marketplace. So we're going to talk about what data breaches are. We're also going to talk about other nasty things that could come to corrupt your data, including things like malware, ransomware, and others. And we'll discuss how these different attacks occur and the different methods that you can do to reduce your risk. I'm going to give you tons of different security tools. I'm going to give you my best advice, the stuff I follow myself with respect to reducing my organization's risk and exposure. Now, data breaches are one thing. However, there's still run-of-the-mill data loss, okay? And data loss can come from corruption of a hard drive. It can come from having files accidentally deleted, and much more. And data loss still happens in a lot of organizations for a lot of different reasons. Accidents, all the way up to intentional deletions based off of maybe a malicious intent of an employee or a competitor who maybe hacks your systems and deletes your data. Having data loss can be just as detrimental to your organization. And in fact, there's been numerous studies that have shown over the years that organizations that lose access to their data face significant risks with respect to staying in business. And it is a business continuity risk for an organization. So we'll talk about why data loss can occur, and I'm also going to focus in this section giving you a backup plan and talking about some different methods of backup. Again, just like a business continuity plan, a backup plan is something you hope to never have to use, but when you need it, you are so thankful that you took the time to put it in place. And so we'll talk about a bunch of different types of backup options and some different approaches at an organizational level that you can do to help bring your business back online in the event of a disaster. Alrighty, so I do want to remind you that if you are a financial professional, and I hope you are, that you can earn credit for today's podcast. Head on over to cpetoday.com, use course code DRB2, take a short 5-question quiz about today's podcast, and you will earn yourself 1 shiny credit for today's podcast, and you'll be well on your way for maintaining your professional licensing. We have CPE credit for all of our podcasts. It's super simple, takes you maybe 2 to 3 minutes to actually earn the credit, and it's a great way to stay on top of your licensing. You know, for myself, and I'm sure most of you, those continuing education credits sneak up on you and you find yourself at the renewal and you might be, 20 or more credits short. Well, guess what? You can earn credits just by listening to a podcast and something you'd maybe do already. So again, if you're interested in earning today's credits, by all means, please head on over to cpetoday.com, use course code DRB2, take a quick exam, and you will earn a credit for today's podcast. Alrighty, so let's do a quick recap with respect to what this series is focusing on and some of the things that we should be familiar with respect to disaster recovery and business continuity. Now, although these are similar concepts, they address different concerns. They have different intentions in terms of what they do. Okay, disaster recovery focuses on the immediate things that need to occur after a disaster. It's about ensuring operations can resume safely and quickly. It's about keeping property, plant, and equipment safe. It, for example, focuses on, let's say, in the event of a hurricane or a tornado, how do we get our people out and how do we bring our office back online once it is safe to do so? And so it really kind of focuses on the first 24 to 72 hours. Now, business continuity, on the other hand, focuses on long-term recovery and survivability of the business, regardless of what occurs. It focuses on putting policy, procedures, people, teams, everything in place to ensure that if a disaster occurs, those disasters will not sink the business. It addresses things, for example, like supply chain. It addresses things like distribution of labor. You know, so if you're in one specific place that unfortunately maybe get hits with a hurricane, or gets hit by a fire or a tornado, maybe having a secondary working location that you can take your staff, or you have a secondary office that staff can resume operations for the company. Okay, so these are related, but they are different from each other. Disaster recovery, immediately after disaster, the first 24 to 72 hours. Business continuity, the bigger picture, long-term focus, how do we stay in business? And it could be a year or it could be longer, just depending on the nature of that disaster. Now, why is this important? Well, disasters are never good. That's the best way of saying it. And they never occur at the time period that you want them to occur in. They always will occur at the most inopportune, bad, worst time they could possibly occur, because that's what a disaster is. They're never convenient. And not doing this isn't really an option. It can result in significant loss of revenue, certainly loss of productivity. You could put people in danger. It can hurt your business's reputation. You could expose yourself to certain governance and compliance regulation issues. And certainly you can cause damage to the environment. You know, so everybody's risks are going to be a little bit different. Okay. The disaster planning for a software company based in California is going to be very different than a nonprofit based in Kentucky or a oil company based in New Orleans. And we need to understand that and address the risks that are most likely to occur to us. Now, let's dive into the meat in for today's course. And so today, what I really want to dive into are kind of data breaches and malware attacks, and then that data loss. Okay. Now, data breaches are not something that just a Google-sized company or an Intel or a Microsoft-sized company has to deal with. You could be a mom-and-pop shop. You could be a Fortune 500. Your data is at risk. And data breaches are on the rise. They are one of the most likely risks that your organization will face in 2021 and certainly beyond. Data has been compared to, and I tend to agree with this, like the black gold of the modern century. It is one of the most valuable things that organizations have, and other people want it for purposes of identity theft, for purposes of exfiltrating the data to steal trade secrets, certainly for financial gain. There are plenty of reasons why people want to steal your organization's data. And we all need to be vigilant with respect to keeping this data safe and secure. You know, security starts at the top and it works its way down. And if the security isn't taken seriously at the chair, board of directors level, and then ultimately senior management and below, it's never going to be a priority for other people. So we have to make sure that this is an organizational priority in terms of what we take seriously. Now, data breaches, and we'll talk more about those here in a minute, can result in a lot of negative things. They are a disaster in their own. You know, it can result in lost revenue, stolen data that's used against you, and certainly harming your reputation. There are plenty of big organizations that I can think of just in the last couple of years. Home Depot, Target, Equifax are probably some of the biggest ones that come to mind. But, there are plenty of smaller data breaches that have occurred that we just don't know about. I'm willing to bet, and I don't have the data to back this up, I am willing to bet that 99% of data breaches that occur, we have no idea, you know? And the reason being is that the requirements for reporting of this aren't consistent, you know? Here in the United States, we have 50 states plus our territories and provinces. That means every state, for the most part, has different reporting and acknowledgement requirements for a data breach. There's 50 different definitions for what they are. In Europe, they've got a little bit more consolidated. They got this nice thing called GDPR, which, while very onerous at the company level to implement, is very beneficial at the individual level to implement and or to use, and the protections it provides to the individual are great. Unfortunately, we really don't have something like that here in the US, and so there's no consistent definition. Okay. But data breaches, regardless of what they are, absolutely are a disaster and absolutely need your attention. If you're dealing with data in some respect, you need to understand what a data breach is and your exposure for it. Let's just skip to the head here. What's your best protection for a data breach? Well, hands down, education of your team and being proactive. Having a conversation about what your data is, security policies, implementing best practices. While it's not going to eliminate your risk, will do a lot to significantly reduce it. You know, let's put on our audit hat for the moment. You know, and we think about, you know, what it was like to audit a company's financial records and books. And, you know, we don't talk about eliminating the risk of fraud. We talk about bringing the risk of fraud to an acceptable level. And it's the same thing with a data breach and malware attacks. We can never get rid of these risks. They're inherent with using technology. However, we can work to mitigate it, to help bring it to an acceptable level for our organizations to be able to continue to operate. Now, as we're getting through here, let's get some standard meanings and use some standard terminology, just so you can have a good frame of reference in terms of where and how these security terms apply to your organization. Okay, there's a couple big ones. Okay, some of the basic terms that we use are things like vulnerabilities, exploits, and malware. Okay, now vulnerabilities are ultimately the thing that will lead to any sort of data breach or any sort of hack or attack. Okay, they are inherent weaknesses that are often found in software or in hardware that enable an attacker to be able to compromise the integrity, availability, or confidentiality of a software or hardware system. Okay. And every application has vulnerabilities. It doesn't matter if you're working with Windows 10, which is certainly much more secure than Windows 8 or Windows XP. You know, it's the most secure operating system Microsoft has ever come up with. Or you're working with the firmware on your printers, on your printer, on a network appliance or an IoT appliance inside your house or your organization. There's always a vulnerability, always. Okay. And we're constantly finding these things. And the nice thing about an update is an update fixes a vulnerability. Okay. When a vulnerability is not fixed, it's not updated, it's not patched, where the bad stuff can actually end up coming in here is that it eventually will turn into an exploit. Okay. So when a vulnerability is discovered and it is not fixed and a bad actor figures that out, they will turn that vulnerability into an exploit. Okay. And that exploit allows malicious code to take advantage of that vulnerability to infect, disrupt, or take advantage of that user's system without consent and without their knowledge. Okay. Now that exploit is almost always done through what we call malware. Okay. Malware is a catch-all term that is used to describe generally just anything nasty that can occur inside of your computer. And malware could be anything from a virus to a worm to a Trojan horse to much more. It's a very inclusive term, and we like this term more than virus because it describes a lot of other things besides just a virus that can occur. But ultimately, all data breaches will result because there's some inherent vulnerability in something. It could be in a server, it could be in a network appliance, it could be on somebody's individual workstation. That vulnerability is discovered and turned into an exploit, and they exploit that vulnerability through using malware. Now, this will ultimately result into a data breach. Okay. A data breach is any incident where confidential or sensitive information is accessed without permission. And that's a very broad term, and that can happen for a lot of different reasons. And there are certainly severity of data breaches. There are some data breaches that are more sensitive than others. Some, for example, might just be stealing encrypted data. Others could be where they steal unencrypted data, and it could be very sensitive data like financial information, healthcare information, and more. But it doesn't matter if it's basic or advanced. Anytime confidential or sensitive data is accessed is without permission would constitute a data breach. Now, again, the words, this is a very broad definition. Depending on where you live, they could have a more specific definition. And there are certain states that have certain safe harbor provisions where if, you know, this happens or this happens, it may or may not constitute a data breach. For example, in some states, depending on if the data was encrypted or not, it might not actually be a data breach. In other states, it doesn't matter if the data was encrypted or not. If it was accessed without permission, it's a data breach. Now, one of the most common types of breaches is done through the facilitation of ransomware. And this is a particularly pervasive, nasty type of malware that has been gaining popularity in the dark web and the dark market for a long time. And it is probably the attack du jour. And I totally understand why and totally understand why these bad actors choose to use it. Okay. Now, ransomware gains access to this person's computer or network or server of some way, and it will infiltrate that user's computer. And what it does is it will pretend that it's something else. It might be a music application. It could be a game. It could be just silent in the background. Okay. Over a period of time, it will proceed to encrypt that user's data. It will lock down that user's data. Sometimes it will exfiltrate that data and transfer it to another server somewhere in the World Wide Web, typically outside of the United States. So it's outside of the jurisdiction of the victim. And then ultimately, it will display a message to this person saying, "Hey, Steve, sorry, you've fallen victim to ransomware. In order to get access to your data and to get it back, you're going to have to pay a fee." You know, and that fee can range anywhere from a couple $100 to hundreds of thousands of dollars, depending on who you are and what type of data that they've taken. And this is almost always paid in the form of cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, Ethereum, something like that, that would be transferred to the attacker's wallet. So data breaches and ransomware really kind of go hand in hand with each other for what they, for how they affect people. You can check out this link if you'd like to learn a little bit more about them. Now, ransomware isn't the only type of breach that can occur. There are other things that can occur as well. And there's other type of attacks that we should be familiar with. Okay. Starting first and foremost with everybody's favorite spam. Okay. No, I'm not talking about the meat and the delicious meat that you can eat in Hawaii for breakfast or have a spam burger, but rather unwanted correspondence. Okay. And it can range from anything from being a benign letter to really kind of catastrophic to an organization. Okay. Benign stuff would be like, you know, an unwanted letter from Aunt Gertrude, you know, that you don't want to read, to catastrophic, where your organization gets bombarded with so much unwanted correspondence that you've eliminated either email or SMS or phone as an option and your normal customers can't get through. You know, some organizations will occur and have spam attacks that can be in the millions of messages in minutes, to the point that it floods their email servers and they're not able to conduct work. Now, a more pervasive and a more malicious type of spam is what we call phishing and spear phishing. Okay. Now, phishing is, and there's bulk phishing and then the spear phishing. Bulk phishing is when we send out tens of thousands, millions, even billions of emails to people all over the world, pretending to be, for example, Bank of America or UPS. And ultimately what we're trying to get them to do is to click on a link and to share their sensitive information, you know, passwords, credit card information, other stuff like that. And then we turn around and we sell it or we use that information for our own. If you've ever gotten an email from the IRS that was horrifically misspelled or didn't seem right, or if you've ever gotten an email from UPS, but not UPS United States, something outside of this that, again, doesn't look right exactly, well, you have received a phishing email. And if you haven't, I'm honestly surprised because this is something most of us deal with every single day. Now, a worse type of spear phishing, and I bring it up because it specifically targets a lot of financial professionals, is called spear phishing. Okay. Now, spear phishing is when you yourself are specifically targeted. And they love going after financial professionals because we typically are the gatekeepers and have access to really sensitive information. And if your organization, for example, deals with international wire transfers, you yourself are, you have a target on your back. You should be aware of this. And this is when they design a specific campaign to manipulate you to willingly handing over your information. And some of you might have experienced this, you know, and you can think and nod yourself silently now if this has happened to you. Have you ever gotten an email from what appeared to be your boss or appeared to be the CFO or CEO of the company asking for you to wire money to an account you've never heard of? Well, that happens all the time, and that's a great example of spear phishing. The person who is in charge of the wire transfers is stalked, typically on services like LinkedIn. They might go through your organization's website trying to find people. They will pretend to be the boss, pretend to be the CEO, ultimately trying to dupe you into wiring money somewhere that you shouldn't wire into. And that happens quite often. Now, one of the most common attacks that we see now, and phishing is certainly a component of it, and it warrants specific attention to discuss this, is social engineering, okay? Most attacks, short of malware and short of ransomware, when we talk about good old-fashioned fraud, especially when it involves technology, it almost always involves social engineering. Okay. And social engineering is the manipulation of a person into performing actions or divulging confidential information. It's essentially a good old-fashioned con job, and this happens more than you can imagine. Most high-profile data breaches aren't really that complicated at the end of the day. It's usually somebody accidentally clicking something they shouldn't have clicked on, opening an email they shouldn't have opened, but they're not really sophisticated, really, at the end of the day. Most of the time, they manipulate somebody to do the heavy lifting. You know, why write a sophisticated, advanced computer malware application when I could just call up and pretend to be the IT company or pretend to be the CEO or pretend to be somebody else and have Bob or Susan or Karen, you know, from accounting or IT willingly hand over this information to us? It happens more than you can think. And they're ultimately trying to manipulate you to willingly handing over information like your password, or they might send you something and then they call you up and try to get you to download something from an email and open it up and it infects your computer or something equally awful. And this happens all the time. If you've ever gotten a phone call from the IRS, you know, and the person on the other side of the phone has a heavy foreign accent, you know, and doesn't seem to really have a strong grasp over how the Internal Revenue Service works, guess what? You are experiencing a social engineering attack. Now, my best advice to all of you is be very wary about what information you give when you're not face to face with somebody. You know, I can tell you right now, anything involving digital communications, a phone call, an SMS message, an email, a fax, all of it can be manipulated and faked. I can do it. I've done it. I've demonstrated this to other people, and you, for the most part, cannot rely on anything being presented to you digitally that it is itself authentic most of the time. You know, there are certain services like DocuSign as an example, or Adobe Sign, where there's a fair amount of authenticity in tracking, but that is the exception to the rule. So be very careful about the people you do business with and the context that you talk about. You might want to identify, for example, identification policies so that you can identify an authorized person from just a fake scammer. Now, if this information is of particular interest to you, I got to tell you about one of my favorite documents that I read every single year. And it is the Data Breach Investigations Report put out by Verizon. Okay. And I get a lot of my ideas around what do I need to prepare? What do I need to think about? What do I want to talk about this year for security to you wonderful folks from this report? In my opinion, it's probably the best written and most comprehensive analysis over data breaches in the whole world. And it's prepared annually by Verizon. They've got contributors worldwide from the Interpol and the FBI and the Secret Service to many other international agencies as well. And it's a survey that looks at all the major data breaches that have occurred, stuff you're familiar with, stuff you probably never even knew that occurred. And it focuses on what happened and, more importantly, what can be done to prevent these issues from occurring in the future. It's really good for gaining insight on current and future state of security. And it's a report that I tend to look at every year to know, what do I need to protect myself and what do I need to protect my business and my clients from? They also go in depth to various industries, major stuff, healthcare, education, professional service, government, manufacturing, to talk about, hey, in your industry, this is what you should be familiar with and work with. In a future podcast, we're going to dive into the current years when they released the 2021 of this. And over a series of podcasts, we're going to dissect the findings from this report. And we're going to talk about it industry by industry about what you should do and what you should operate with and what you should be mostly preparing yourself for. All right, let's go ahead and have our first review question for the day. All righty. So, which of the following attacks could result in a data breach for your organization? Is it downloading malware from a website? Absolutely. That can certainly result in getting a data breach for your organization. Is it opening an email attachment which was infected by a virus? You betcha that would work. Plugging in a USB drive that contained malicious code. You should be aware of these little guys. If you haven't seen one before, this is a USB thumb drive. You know, and I've got several of them for different purposes. However, I'm very careful about where I get them, and I don't like them coming from other people. You'll see these often at trade shows. They'll be given away, you know, at least when we used to get together in person in the pre-COVID days. And I always cringe when people just stick them into their computers without knowing where they came from, because they absolutely can infect your computer with malicious code. So that's also. So our correct response here is all of the above. Any of these can result in a data breach to your organization. So speaking of data breaches, let's talk about some of the things that we could do to help reduce our risk and exposure. Okay, so if you suspect a data breach, here is some quick advice that I would recommend that you take a look at and consider. Even if there isn't a data breach, ultimately, this is good advice even when you suspect it. So I would recommend you double check the status of all the updates on your system. Make sure that things are up to date. If not up to date, get them up to date. Run the updaters on Windows and Office and these other solutions. We'll talk more about update here in a little bit. Okay. If you have an anti-malware solution, and I hope you do, run a detailed deep scan across your different possibly infected systems and see if there is some malicious code that is running on there. And hopefully if it's a reputable anti-malware solution, you know what? It should catch it. Now, if you do find a problem, your best bet, especially with ransomware, absolutely disconnect that device from the internet and disconnect it from the other devices in the network. Ransomware, malware can spread to other devices in the network. And if you disconnect it, you're going to make and reduce your risk to a more acceptable level. And you reduce your opportunity for that malware to, you know, jump over and infect other machines in the network. If you have an IT department, this would be a fabulous time to call them. It's better to get them involved early and not be a big deal than, you know, kind of call them hat in hand, you know, a day later with a full-blown attack. You know, this is what they do, you know, and they should be able to provide guidance, support, insight to make good decisions and hopefully assist with the resolution of whatever issue popped up. Now, if you do find a data breach, you have an obligation, and I'm going to say in most instances, a moral obligation, all the way up to a fiduciary obligation to report this, certainly to management, and then probably beyond that to maybe the audit committee of the company or maybe even law enforcement, depending on what has occurred. You're going to need to double check your state's specific requirements on what constitutes a data breach and when third-party reporting is required. And you're probably also going to want to contact legal counsel depending on what data was compromised and what was stolen. So this would be kind of my base steps in terms of what I would recommend for you to double check you know, the updates in your systems, running a malware check, and then ultimately getting people involved to reduce your risk and exposure. Now, on an individual level, a question I often get asked is, Steve, how the heck am I going to know if I was affected by this? How am I going to know if my data has been compromised or stolen? Well, unfortunately, the answer is you're probably not. You know, I mentioned this when we were getting started that it's my belief 99% of data breaches go unreported. And I think that's probably pretty accurate. However, we do have knowledge, especially on the really big data breaches, what occurred. And we know, for example, Equifax breach occurred. We know the IRS had a breach in about 2015-16. We know Target had a breach. We know Home Depot had a breach. It's because some of this information will usually get leaked, and then ultimately some security researchers will figure it out and then will get involved in sharing that information with the public. And there are databases that you can look up to see if your information was publicly exposed in a data breach. Now, one of my favorite resources, I'm going to show you this here in a minute, it's haveibeenpwned.com. And I know it's a funny word maybe for some of you, but pwned is an internet term that mostly just means got attacked or got compromised. And it's a website run by a security researcher named Troy Hunt that's been around for a long time, and he tracks data breaches that have been publicly known. So he tracks this stuff, and he has some tools that are really, really, really useful that can tell you if you yourself have been compromised, or at an institutional level, it can tell you if your institutions have been compromised or a staff member in your institution has been compromised. Okay. It can even notify you in the event that other attacks occur and other data becomes known. So this is a website. It's one of my favorites to recommend. It is so useful for so many different reasons. And I want to show to you here, and I'll give you an example of how you can use it. Okay, so let's go ahead and take a look at this. And so the website again is haveibeenpwned.com. And this is the front page of that specific website. Okay, now what you can do over here is you can just provide an email. Okay. And so let's just pick the probably pretty generic email. Let's say johnny@gmail.com. Okay. And if we look at this and there was a data breach, we would see, for example, the data breaches that email was potentially exposed to. And so we can see here that johnny@gmail.com was exposed on 132 different breaches. And if we scroll down here, we can see which data breaches, which have been made publicly known, that johnny@gmail.com was exposed to. And so we can see down here it was exposed into an Adobe attack. We can see it was on an Apollo attack, so on and so forth. And so it'll tell you, for example, as you're looking through this, like what was taken. For this Bitly attack, for example, they got Johnny's email, his username, and his password. If we look at some of the other ones that are listed here, sometimes there's more damning information that was taken. You know, especially for websites that are tracking more than just username and password. You know, if they were tracking like your address, for example, or your date of birth, things of this nature. In this particular one down here, email addresses, the employer, the IP address, titles, so on and so forth. So this is a great website to be able to keep track of where your data has been exposed. Now, if you click up here to this notify me, you could drop in your email, and in the event of a future breach where your email is exposed, they will send you a quick email letting you know that occurred. Okay. And just know, I know some people get weirded out about submitting and, you know, checking. This is a reputable site run by a reputable person. Now, at the company level, if you come over here to the domain search, you can put in a company name and a company email, and it will tell you in the future or if there has been anything exposed that you should know about. You know, so for example, if we come over here and let's just go ahead and put in cpetoday.com. Okay, this is going to go ahead and get notified in the event that any of our emails get exposed in a breach. Okay, there we go. So we have to go through a quick verification thing to prove that we are who we are. And we're going to skip that for the time being, but this is a great way to keep an eye on this at a institutional level. They also have tons of information on what companies have been exposed. So if you want to kind of read through that, and they also have a really cool service over here. And we'll talk about passwords here in a minute that will actually review your passwords and tell you, for example, if a password has ever been exposed in a data breach. Now, we'll talk more about passwords here in a minute, but you never, ever, ever want to use a password that has been exposed in a breach, because we know what those exposed passwords are. Hackers don't just randomly pick letters and numbers and see if that works. They use this list of, in this case, 613 million already real world exposed passwords to determine what to, you know, what to expose and what to use for their brute force attacks. So if we use something like baseball one, okay, we're going to go ahead and see that that baseball one password has been exposed 227,000 times. Even baseball 123 has probably been exposed several thousand times as well. You know, so it's a great way of kind of keeping track of what exposure you might have. Okay, so let me give you some of my best practices and some of my enterprise security recommendations that you should use. Now, first and foremost, do not trust your users to make good and consistent security decisions. In practice, just ain't gonna happen. I mean, I love my users, I love my clients, but really security needs to be addressed at an institutional level, at a policy level, and then applied uniformly from the CEO to the intern. And often your worst offenders are gonna be at the top of the list versus at the bottom of the list. So personally, I tell you, policy, you should have people who are competent in this. You should set up standard security practices and then work to implement those uniformly across the company. You know, so if you have requirements with respect to your passwords, well, they apply to the CEO all the way down to the intern. I will tell you that with respect to security, it's either right or it's not. I mean, you can't be a little right and a little wrong. I will say security is an onion where there are multiple layers inside of it, but for the most part, like, it's a very precise thing. It's a specific thing, and there's a specific way that needs to be done and a specific way that it needs to be implemented. And if you don't have this area of knowledge, you should acquire it. Either hire a consultant, hire a security professional, but do not John Wayne this. Do not shoot from the hip. Do not try to do it on your own. I'm telling you, even as a security researcher and IT professional and software developer myself, I'm constantly learning. And the more I learn, the more I realize I don't know. And even for somebody who does this for a living, there's so much specific stuff just around security that it is almost impossible just to keep up for a competent professional, let alone somebody who doesn't do this for a living. So I would recommend that you engage with a competent security professional for your industry. Now, some general best practices, and we're not going to go into crazy in depth, and this is pretty obvious stuff, so most of you should probably already have a pretty good understanding of this, but things that you should have for your organization. Antivirus, anti-malware is a must. This is software that is going to protect your computers, your servers from intrusive and malicious code and malicious software. Lots of great options to choose from. I will tell you, there is, if you're a Windows user, Windows Server user, Windows Desktop user, absolutely, probably more so than any other system or software, Windows in particular, just because it's so ubiquitous. I mean, Windows has like a 90%+ of the desktop market. As such, almost all malware is specifically designed to run in the Windows environment. So if you're running Windows, whether it be server or desktop, absolutely. Now, lots of great options to choose from. Here's a really cool website. This is avtest.org. And what avtest.org does is they specifically independently monitor and they independently review, for example, different anti-malware, antivirus software. And so if you come on over here to avtest.org, you can look at their tests. They've got, for example, reviews for home and business. And if we look here, is as of the time of this recording in February, we could see, for example, the software that they have reviewed for malware. And they give it this a score typically out of 6. And there's a lot of really, really good solutions that are out there, you know, for what they do. Now, my personal recommendation, the one that I run, is Trend Micro. Our company runs it across the board. I've thankfully always had pretty good luck with it. It's very reasonably priced. And if you're going to buy anti-malware software, I should tell you, you should budget somewhere around $50 per user per year. If you're buying it for your house, about the same. You know, that's typically what it comes into. Now, if you choose not to buy it and you're running Windows 10, you also have Windows Defender, which is a great option in of itself. These other solutions provide additional coverage beyond what Windows Defender does. But if you bought nothing and just use the standard Windows operating system, you're going to be okay. So lots of great options there that you can consider for your company. And there's going to be different use cases depending on when you might want to use one or the other. So you're going to need some network security appliances, specifically a firewall and, depending on your specific risk case, what we would call intrusion protection hardware or software as well. A firewall is a physical device or a software device that prevents unauthorized access into or out of your network. And so it prevents people from Russia, China, Europe, other parts of the world that you don't do business with from interacting with your company and maybe potentially remoting into a machine in your network. Intrusion prevention is about detecting, okay, and then notification when unauthorized access occurs inside that network. And they can go hand in hand. They sometimes are the same device and sometimes they can be different. Gartner has a great review of different firewall appliances. If you check out that URL, you can go ahead and figure out what solution might work best for your company and for your specific use case. Now, often our first and our only line of defense in almost all circumstances are going to be authentication procedures. And authentication and passwords are synonymous with each other. When we talk about accessing our Gmail account or logging into Office 365, we do so through the use of a username and password. And there's some best practices with respect to passwords that you should know. And having a good, strong password and doubling it up with multi-factor authentication is often the best thing that you can do. And it can, in most circumstances, be the only thing you can do. As a user, you control what password you use, but you don't necessarily control how the company hosts their data, what authentication protocols they're using, how the data is encrypted. You know, so the most you could hope for yourself on a consistent basis would be using a good password. A couple things I'd recommend. Email. Always use a separate email password. Make it complex. Never, ever use that password for anything else. Your email password's used for email, and that's it. Okay? Now, I also recommend that you use a password manager. Lots of great options. The one that I personally recommend that we use often in our business and with our clients is LastPass. Doesn't matter which one you choose. Just pick something that's reputable. Besides LastPass, RoboForm, KeyPass, OnePass, Dashlane, Zoho Vault, all of which are good. I didn't list the one that you're using. As long as it's pretty reputable from a big company or at least a well-known company, you're probably just fine. Now, passwords managers do a couple of things. First and foremost, they are a methodology for storing your passwords in an organized way. It keeps them secured and encrypted. It will store them in a single location. You will typically have access to this on your mobile device and then also on the computers that you use. And so it makes recalling these passwords simple, fast, efficient, and easy. It will also generate those passwords for you. Okay, so humans aren't good at remembering long, complex passwords. We're just not good at that. That is not what our brains are designed to do. However, computers are, you know, and so a password to be effective, it really should be upwards of 16 characters. It should contain a couple of different categories of characters, including uppercase, lowercase, numerics, special. And there is a direct correlation in a password strength with its length and complexity. The longer you can make it and the more varied of the characters that are in there, the more secure that password is going to be. Okay. Well, these tools will generate those random characters, passwords that have never existed before and never will again. And that would be your password to the different websites you choose to use and services you choose to use. So when I want to, for example, log into Delta Airlines, or I want to go book a hotel at Hilton or Marriott, I don't know the passwords to those sites. Okay. I go into my LastPass, I look for Hilton, and then I copy and paste that password, or often I'm using the browser extension and I just let that application log in for me. really, there's only three passwords you need to know, okay? You need to know the password to get into your device, into your computer. You need a password to get into your email. I always recommend you keep that kind of separately. If I can compromise your email, I can compromise really kind of anything about you. And the third thing is your password in the LastPass. You know, for all the thousands of other passwords you have, it doesn't matter. LastPass knows them, KeePass knows them, Dashlane knows them, and you can log in that way. It's a very secure method. And we're going to talk specifically on password managers in a future podcast. So if this is an area of interest to you, we're going to go very deep on LastPass, KeePass, and Dashlane, a lot of these other solutions, talking about their strengths and weaknesses, giving you specific insight on how to properly leverage these tools in your life. Now, the absolute... In addition to your password, the absolute next best thing you can do with respect to authentication is to utilize multi-factor authentication, or MFA. Now, you probably have already experienced this at some point. Multi-factor authentication is when you provide an additional security method above and beyond just the password itself. Okay. So, typically what will happen, let's say for Facebook or LinkedIn or any of these services, Amazon for that matter, I will provide my username and I will provide my password, okay? And then when I want to authenticate and go into it, it will then ask for an additional code to be able to provide access. And that code will typically be what we would call a one-time password. And that code will be sent by text message. It will get sent by, or maybe generated on your mobile device, and it'll be in an app itself. And you'll provide your normal username and password, and then this code. Okay. Now, why is this more secure? And what kind of security promotion does this provide? Okay. Well, the biggest thing that it provides is the fact that if your password is stolen through a data breach, you know, some company that you've done work with has their databases compromised, their information stolen. Well, if they get your password, they can log into that account. However, if they don't get your password, I'm sorry, if they do get your password and you have two-factor authentication on, well, they're not going to be able to log in. They're not going to be able to go anywhere with that information. Okay. That password, that one-time code being generated, is being sent through another protocol, through a different method that they would literally have to have your password plus have stolen most often your physical device, your phone, in order to be able to get into that account. And so it pretty much across the board eliminates your risk of having your accounts compromised if you use two-factor authentication. Now, there are three types of authentication. You can do things you know. So knowledge-based authentication, that would be the first method, in this case, a password or a PIN number. Things you have, things in your possession, such as a badge or smartphone, that would be, for example, a SMS text message being sent to that phone. And they can also test things you are. So biometric stuff, you know, for example, Face ID on Apple devices or Touch ID, you know, any one of those. In addition to a password, actually, let me rephrase that. These are the three methods of multi-factor authentication. You need to pick two out of the three to consider it MFA. So often it would be things you know, like a password, and then either a biometric confirmation of your identity, or more often than not, like a text message with a code. But you do these two things, you're going to be secure. And I would tell you that you should utilize multi-factor authentication as much as possible. Now, my best possible advice overall for prevention of a data breach, if you did one thing, okay, I've got three things I want you to do, but this is the biggest out of them. Keep your computers and all related server and network gear up to date. If we look at malware, we look at ransomware, almost exclusively across the board, it targets old software, it targets old versions of Windows, it targets old versions of Windows Server. And this is what ultimately they're looking for. They're hoping you're using an old version of something because their code, most often than not, does not work against the current version. So if you kept your devices up to date, that's the first thing. You use a strong password, that's the second thing. And the third thing, use multi-factor authentication. Those three things, 99 times out of 100, are probably enough to keep the average user secure. Okay, stay up to date, use a strong password, use multi-factor authentication. And that's about the best you could hope for at the individual level. Alrighty. let's go ahead and have our second review question for the day. All right. In addition to a password, which of the following is not a practical example of multi-factor authentication? Okay. So what is not a factor of multi-factor authentication? Is it an SMS message with a one-time code? Nope. That is a great example of multi-factor. Is it a one-time code generated by an authentication app? Nope. That would not be a good example of multi-factor. Is it answering a question that is widely known? That is not a good example of multi-factor authentication. The reason being is that you've already provided a password, which is something you know. Well, just answering a not known question, that's not a really good example. So I would tell you that would be the one that I would not use for multi-factor. Using a fingerprint reader or facial recognition, that's not the option either. Because that is a factor of, something you are. So the correct answer here is what is not a practical example of multi-factor would be anything where you duplicate another method. So if you're testing something you know, you then need to test something you are or something you have, either biometric or through like a text message. Okay, so we got about 10 minutes left here. I want to spend just a few minutes on our second section for today, and we'll probably continue to dive deeper into this in future podcasts. We're going to do one specifically on backup, but I did want to introduce this topic for us because it is something that is really important and a major component of disaster recovery specifically, and that is preventing data loss with backups. Okay. There's been a number of studies. The one that most recently comes to mind was one that was put together in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina by the Department of Commerce that looked at the affected businesses there. And they found that businesses that did not have access to their data for a prolonged period of times maybe didn't go out of business immediately, but that interruption was something they never recovered from. And so data loss is just as detrimental to an organization as a hurricane in some respects, or a tornado. And they can happen for different reasons. I mean, malware, for example, could infect your network, wipe out your servers, wipe out your backups. And what are you going to do from that point? We also have physical failure too. I mean, all devices, doesn't matter how bright and shiny and new it is, the day you get it, will die, and will die in a unpredictable and often catastrophic and often at the worst possible time that you need it. So physical devices don't last forever. We ideally need to replace them before they fail, and we want to have a backup plan in place in the event that they do. We never want to have to use a backup, but it is something we absolutely cannot recreate if we don't do it proactively. This is something you can't do at any point. You have to do it ahead of time. So, why is this important? Well, think about the cost, payroll cost, and everything that goes into recreating a single day of work, let alone, what would happen if you were a tax professional and this happens on March 31st. I mean, what the heck is going to happen? Now, all devices will eventually die. Here's an example of a hard drive. Thankfully, this is becoming less and less relevant because we have cloud technology, and we also have, for example, solid state disks, and thankfully backup is so much easier, but hard drives die. They die for a ton of different reasons. Power failure, they can get damaged because of movement. Over here, we could see, for example, a hard disk where the reading arm has essentially scratched this disk. This is 100% unusable. All this data is lost. Here's an example of a hard drive that was burned up in a fire. Clearly not going to be able to recover anything. And sometimes we have what we call a logical failure, where the disk just dies because of either a bad software update or something else. And sometimes you could see the issue and sometimes not. One of the best tips, especially with anything mechanical, is avoid using mechanical stuff to begin with. For example, using a solid state disk is a much better option because it has a lower failure rate, uses less power, and it's also a lot faster. So just realize by the time a hard disk fails, that ship has sailed. There are data recovery places, but even under the best of circumstances, you've got a 50-50 shot, and those odds can go down dramatically, depending on the circumstances of what occurs. So backup. It's the most important plan that you hope to never have to use. Okay. And data loss at best will slow down your organization, and at worst, it will put you out of business. And it's important to have a plan together before you actually need it. Now, for a good backup plan, it should be automatic. it should be redundant, it should be offsite, and it should be regularly tested. Meaning, I shouldn't have to institute a backup. It should just happen automatically on a schedule. Typically, we will script these things, and then the computer will execute that backup script once an hour, once a day, hopefully no more than once a week. It should be redundant. You should not put all your eggs in one basket where, oh, we just back up to this one thing, or we just back up to this, you know, one little drive. And, you know, as long as we have this one little drive, we have a backup. It's a terrible option. For backups to be considered highly available and reliable, they need to be in three locations and they need to be three copies. You should not put all your eggs in one basket and have them all in the same place. They should be in multiple facilities. Maybe you keep a copy at home. Maybe you keep a copy in the cloud. Let's say if you're using cloud, well, if you use Amazon for everything, you should use Azure for your backup, or at least have a copy of it there. And you need to regularly test it, ensure that it is available and it works and it is still something that you can use. You never want to, for example, be in a position for that recovery only to find out that your backup isn't working. Now, there's lots of different styles of backups. There's lots of different methodologies. And I'm just going to say backup really kind of comes in two flavors: real time or periodic batch. Okay. Ideally, you want to do real time as much as possible. Real time ensures that as soon as a file is changed, that change is backed up somewhere else. A good example of this would be like Microsoft OneDrive, Google Drive. These are file sharing and syncing services. Okay. Anytime you make a change, it sees that change and then writes that change to Google, writes that change to Microsoft as soon as that file is updated. And this all always is automatically backing up the computer in real time. Now, we also do periodics. These are typically daily, weekly, monthly, hopefully not monthly, that occur typically in batches, and they will do a full system backup. And it's not that one is better than the other. If I had to choose, I'd say real time's better than periodic for some reasons, but they have different reasons and different results, and they have different intended goals. I would say that for an organization, it's not one or the other, but both, you know, in both in terms of what you want to choose and how you want to go about doing that. You know, you should build in, for example, a couple of different backup methodologies, you know, in terms of how you choose to do this. For example, full backups, incremental backups, and differentials. Do you back up everything? Do you only back up the stuff that has changed? There's different methods for handling that. And we also have different ways we can conduct this and where this data is being stored. You know, is this data being stored on site in the office? What's great about that is it's fast, it's local, it's cheap, but not great if the building burns down. Well, maybe we'll just do offsite. Well, it's slower, it's marginally more expensive, and does require internet connection. What happens if the internet dies? I mean, yeah, we've got coverage in case of the building burning down, but you know, it could take a long time to restore that. Ideally, we want a hybrid. We want to implement both real-time and periodic. We want an option of both on-site and off-site with respect to what we choose to do. Now, for an organization that is serious about disaster recovery, you might also choose to have a backup work site. Okay. Thankfully, with COVID, you know, cloud technology has gone up, remote office technology has gone up. It's so simple now. I mean, your backup site could be as simple as just sending your staff home to work from home. That works, you know, or it could be having a whole separate facility in the event that your building burns down. We have three different types. We have cold sites, we have hot sites, and we have warm sites. Okay. And these are great for organizations with very specific continuity requirements that need to maintain operations like a call center, data center, manufacturing facility, where if that facility itself was taken offline, what are we going to do? Okay. Cold sites are basically just empty operational spaces with basic facilities. They would take time, money, and resources to bring them online. Okay, we have hot sites. These are pretty much an exact duplicate of the original site. All the computer stuff, phone stuff, messaging, communication, all of it is right there and a copy of the data. Building A burns down, everybody moves over to building B, and we don't skip a beat. But most organizations, for example, do warm sites, you know, where it's a compromise between hot and cold. They got some stuff there, but they're not ready to go. They might take a day or a week to bring online, you know, and warming up that site will depend on what resources are required and, you know, how quick you want to bring it online. Here's kind of a cool graph that kind of illustrates the differences between some of these hot site and cold sites. We've got an axis of cost. We've got an axis of time. As you can imagine, with a hot site, well, the benefit is takes no time to come up line, but it's expensive just to have a whole nother facility sitting by in the event you might need it. You know, warm site being a little less expensive, and a cold site, you know, it's just basically having a building. It's not really expensive, but takes a lot more time to get up. You know, ideally what you want to find here is a happy middle ground. And this is going to be different for every company. You want to find an approach that balances between cost and risk, something that isn't going to break the bank, but also isn't going to break the company if you can't come online fast enough. Now, what I will point out, it's never been a better time to move to the cloud. You know, in the event of a disaster, if you're utilizing cloud technology, recovering, if you're a cloud-based company, is the absolute fastest, cheapest, and most efficient way of doing it, and effective as well, compared to on-premise equipment. You know, building burns down, you had a whole bunch of servers in it. Well, how the heck are you going to get those servers back online? I mean, best case scenario, it'll take a month for Dell or HP, whoever made those servers, to recreate them for you and ship them and all that other stuff. Versus if you're using Amazon or Azure, I mean, in just a fraction of a second, I can fire up another instance of something and immediately bring that data back to life if need be. You know, and so backing up and restoring data from a cloud position is so much better from a risk management perspective than on-premise and traditional methods. So I would tell you, as you're starting to look at data loss inside your organization, if cloud is not a significant component of your operations, you're missing the boat. You're missing you're missing a big opportunity for the company. All right, that does bring us to the end of our presentation for today. Let's go ahead and have our final review question. Okay, which of the following is not a characteristic of a quality backup methodology? Okay, is it everything should be in one place? You know what? That is not part of a quality backup methodology. So that is our answer. But let's look at the other three. Okay. A good backup methodology absolutely should be automatic, should not require a user to initiate it. It should be redundant in multiple places, and it should be regularly tested. You don't want to come to the end of this only to find out that your backup wasn't working and it wasn't correct. Okay, so in summary, what did we learn today? Well, we talked about data breaches, and we talked about what they are and how they can leak sensitive information. We also talked about data loss and what the effect could be in the organization, how we can minimize that risk through having a good backup plan. Now, this is episode 2. We're going to do a whole bunch on this with disaster recovery and business continuity. In future episodes of this series, we're going to talk again more about different disaster types and different methods for restoring data in those positions and reducing our risk for those particular disasters. And we're also going to take a look at writing a business continuity plan and a disaster recovery plan, putting pen to paper, if you will, you know, or maybe fingers to keyboards, and actually putting together a plan for our organization that will proactively make decisions about what we're going to do and how we are going to do it in the event of a disaster. All right. So please stay tuned. So much more great information coming. Now, as our final reminder, if you are a financial professional, and I hope you are, you can earn credits for listening or watching to today's broadcast. I know. You can earn a credit very quickly. It'll take you just a couple of minutes. Head on over to cpetoday.com. Use course code DRB2. And you'll take a short 5-question exam, and you will earn a completion certificate, and you'll be well on your way for maintaining your licensing. So very easy to do, very fast to do. Check it out. You can get your credits today. And we're putting out new episodes twice a week, typically Tuesdays and Fridays at 11 Pacific, that you can watch live on Facebook, YouTube, and on our website itself. So if you enjoyed today's broadcast, would love for you to leave a comment. Let us know what you liked. If you have any questions, or if you have any material that maybe you'd like to see us discuss in a future podcast, love to do it. You can find us on most social media at CPE Today. Okay. And as a reminder, you can also listen to our podcast anytime you'd like. We're on a variety of streaming platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google, SoundCloud, and more. We'd love for you to leave a review, subscribe, like, and let us know what you think. We're a growing business. We're just getting started here. We've got so much more great content to come, but we can't do it without you. So please consider tuning in and following us and letting us know how we can serve you better. It has been my absolute and sincere privilege to present this material for you. Stay tuned. Many more great episodes to come. Take care, and I'll see you the next time.